My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter and I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. In this episode, we speak with a former paratrooper who is changing the way plant medicine is seen. From his own traumatic experiences in conflict, to his stress and trauma symptoms, to the drink that changed his life. From the Parachute Regiment to Heroic Hearts UK, episode 46, Keith Abraham. This is Declassified. Where did you grow up?
I was born in Greenwich in South London, and I grew up in the sort of North Kent, South London areas, Bexley Heath and Welling, Plumstead and places like that. I grew up in a relatively affluent household, so quite a stable home. I had a few conflicts with my father, but generally, you know, I was well looked after. I was loved in the way that my parents loved me. And I feel like I had a pretty happy, playful childhood. Like most people, you know, we have our issues. But I certainly can't complain.
What did your mum and dad do when you was really little?
My dad worked a lot. He was a salesman, like a print salesman. And my brother's disabled. And so my mum really, I didn't know this before I was born, she worked in Whitehall as a secretary, but she quit when she had my brother. He's older than me. Because he's disabled, you know, she required a lot of help. But as we grew up and he went into certain full-time schools, then she did jobs like driving buses for kids, getting them to school, being a dinner lady and things like this. So quite menial work, but it kept her out of the house, which I think is what she wanted after those quite difficult years.
What's the age difference between yourself and your brother?
2 years.
Oh, so it's a close.
Yeah,
were you two close growing up?
Yeah, well, I love him like my brother.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's hard to. He's disabled, so it's like I know he loves me as well, but he's mentally and physically disabled, so there's it's not a common. I don't want to say normal relationship, but. You know, I love him. He's my brother.
Yeah,
and I know that he loves me as well.
Yeah. Did you look after him growing up, or is it similar to what brothers are like?
Yeah, kind of. And I'm the younger brother, and I beat him up. Yeah, I think I cracked his head open 8 times or something. I was really despicable. Yeah, really. You know, we both liked our WWF. He still does. So I was suplexing him off of swimming pool onto radiators, all sorts of damage.
Yeah.
But, he still loves me.
That's good. Was you, I'm talking primary school, was you a good kid? Was you disrupted? Would you be classed as naughty? What was schooling like?
No, I had quite a lot of respect for authority at that period, but I was pretty highly strung as a kid. You know, I got into a lot of fights, but not in the classroom. That was outside in the playground. I didn't like getting picked on, but I wasn't necessarily very tough either. So I got into a lot of confrontation. And I didn't naturally like confrontation, so it's quite upsetting, quite an unpleasant experience. But I wasn't naughty or ill-behaved or anything like that, but I was highly strung, so I could go a bit wild from time to time.
Mm. Did your parents used to tell you off?
Yeah, my dad used to shout at me quite a bit. So and again, I didn't like confrontation and I didn't like upsetting anyone. So then my dad comes home from work and he just bawls at me all the time for doing these stupid things that kids do, that boys do, you know.
Mm.
So, yeah, I wasn't naughty, but I messed up from time to time.
Yeah, yeah, you'd stick up for yourself as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then going into almost kind of like the puberty then, you know, when you go into your teen years and everything changes, that aggression gets channeled in a different way and you look for other things, I suppose, with masculinity. How did that transition go then, especially into primary school, into senior school? Was it more the same or?
Yeah, when I started going through puberty and a little bit later as well, I became more reckless then. I think it was the way that I see it now, having reflected on it a little bit, is that I was a bit disappointed and I really had no right to be. I just had quite high ideals of what life should be, intuitively, instinctively, as a quite a small child. And life didn't turn out with those ideals in place. And so I was quite disappointed. And then I was quite resentful and quite bitter. And then I was angry. And so as I grew older, I was angry. And then I was self-destructive.
In what way?
I drank a lot, more than what I would say is most young men drink. I really went for it. I was actually trying to destroy myself as opposed to let's go crazy.
Mm. What age is that?
I think I started drinking pretty early. Not really early, but I don't know. Let's say 15, something like that. I was finding access to alcohol. And I kind of just started going off the rails then. Just because of that, you know, lack of self-worth as well as a young man. And not quite knowing my place. I had these ideals, like I was saying. And my ideals were, you might laugh, but my ideals were kind of focused around, I wanted to be the hero like Luke Skywalker or Maverick from Top Gun. I wanted to serve and help people, and I wanted adventure. And life in South London is not full of adventure. It's like petty, and there's a lot of alcohol and drugs, and I'm generalizing massively, but a lot of people just get stuck there.
Mm.
That might be true of a lot of England as well, actually, but all I know is where I'm from. And I was getting stuck. And there was no view of adventure. So hence, I thought, I might as well destroy myself. So drinking and drugs.
Was there any youth clubs available or cadet forces or anything? Was there anything to channel that?
I was in the Scouts. I really liked Scouts, but I kind of found a way to drink in Scouts. And I was a bit disruptive there as well by that point. But I liked being out. I like being out in the tents and at the aeroplane display. You know, you could go to Duxford or there's a few airfields, World War II airfields, they do those annual things. I really liked all of that sort of stuff, and camping out, making fires, going to see the aeroplanes and veterans and stuff like that.
Well, where do you think that disappointment comes from then? You know, you said you were disappointed in the way it was working out for you. Where do you think that comes from, especially at such a young age?
I just didn't think that I could achieve that. So I didn't believe that I could actually join a unit that would be of great service. So I saw myself as the first thing I ever approached professionally. So my career path was actually a fighter pilot. And I went into the careers office and the guy was I was quite shy as well. I was really young. And the guy just said, no, you're not cut out for this. It doesn't really matter what your grades are going to be. You're not cut out as a character for this. I just thought, it's pretty harsh for a young man. You know? Maybe I wanted some more support than that. Kind of crushed me a little bit. And I didn't even think about things like the parachute regiment or anything else. I just, these ideals of, being a pilot, being of service and kind of going after bad guys. You know?
When you joined in, when you was 24, but before we get to that point, why did it take you so long then to find that kind of, I suppose the Avengers, you know, like that, the place where you was going to do that. Yeah. That unit that you mentioned, why did it take you? Cause that is quite late.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very late. I actually needed trauma. I needed a massive traumatic catalyst. And what that was the breakdown of my relationship with my partner at the time and we had only just had our son, my son Dylan, who's now actually in the reg as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And when she left and took him away, that was the first suicidal point in my life as well, as a point of reference. This was 20. I was 20. I actively tried to kill myself. But it was kind of like, well, I've got nothing left now. And then a year later, 9/11 hit, and I just thought, you know what? I've got nothing left. And now there's some bad guys on the, you know, there's some really quite clear bad guys that need dealing with. Maybe this is what I can go and do. And so I did. It still took me 2.5 years after 9/11. I had to try myself out. You know, I was a heavy, heavy drinker and drug user by that point, even though I was holding down full-time work. Yes, I needed to get myself in relative shape to join.
Yeah, you needed to sort yourself out. And yeah, there was a purpose. There was a clear goal there, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Go back to the when you'd separated and your little boy at the time was taken away from you. Why and how did you get to the point? I don't want to talk about the actual suicide or the method of suicide, but how and why did you get to that point? What was the feelings behind taking your own life, especially with a son that would need you growing up? Was that logical thought in there?
No. Yeah, and I think that's important to remember for people that have got suicidal ideation. It's like there's not often rational thought there. So no, I didn't have that thought. I was simply hopeless and thought that everything had been taken from me and that I couldn't possibly hope to get it back. And that's how I felt. I just felt totally hopeless and that everything was pointless. But I was already coming from a point of view where I was pretty disappointed with how life was anyway.
Mm.
And to have the woman that I loved and my son taken away, that was kind of just a bit too much. So I just thought, you know what, I've been trying hard for all of these years. I might as well give it another go. But
did you, and I'm not putting words into your mouth, you can just shoot me down. Did you feel like you was a role model, a good role model to your son then?
I didn't even think of role models at that point. No, and I wasn't.
Did you have good friends around you?
I had a lot of friends and some of them are still my friends and we've grown together and we've developed together, but we probably didn't help each other out. We were in a downward spiral together.
Mm.
Another friend of mine really went into quite a dark place and I have lost contact with him since. So we weren't really there. We were there to take each other lower, not to help lift us out.
Mm. Would you say you was you dependent on alcohol and drugs?
Yeah. But I was functioning. Yeah. So I was holding down full-time work as well.
And what were you doing at that time, work?
I worked in book publishing.
Right, okay. And how did you mask it?
I don't know if I did.
Really?
I was pretty messy. Yeah. And in publishing as well, my bosses, you know, certainly one or two of my bosses were full-blown alcoholics as well. So it's kind of like, oh, welcome to the team.
Mm.
You're one of us.
The culture.
Yeah, the culture was heavy drinking. You know, I'd get to start work at 9 and at midday we'd turn our computers off and go to the pub and we wouldn't come back.
Jeez.
Which was great from that perspective.
Yeah.
But terrible for the health and what I needed. Hence, I left.
So let's talk about a complete change in culture then. You know, you got yourself, you had this goal, you'd set it. What did it feel like to initially join?
It's daunting. It was daunting because I chose the parachute regiment. I asked the guy in the recruit, I didn't know anything about the reg as well. I just asked the recruiting officer. It's like, who are the hardest and who are the ones likely to be going to war? And he said the parachute regiment. So I put my name down. Mm. And but it was daunting when I started doing a little bit of research when I turned up in Catterick. But very quickly, I was like, this is amazing. The indoctrination that I was getting, full-blown mental indoctrination. I don't know if you're aware of what happens in the reg. Love a bit of regimental indoctrination.
Mm.
And I needed it and I loved it. It still makes me smile to this day. I mean, it's crazy, but I've watched my son go through it as well. So it's very funny and it's valuable to a point.
Mm. And then getting your berry.
Yeah, it was great. Yeah, it was great.
Did you feel like you'd part of something then?
Yeah. Yeah. I was probably incorrect in that assumption because when you turn up, you're very aware that you're not part of it. And that's highlighted pretty quickly. But I didn't really care anyway because I knew I was in.
Mm.
And it was just a question of just it's always just a question of not quitting in that, you know, in the training. As long as you're still there at the end, you pass. This is a regimental kind of, it's the fact of our training. So I just thought, no, I'll just hang in there, I'll be all right.
And what was the relationship with your son like then in 2004?
So from my perspective, because he always, from what I can gather, he's always idolized me. He might say something different if he hears this. But from my perspective, I was then, you mentioned role models before, I was like, oh, I'm quite a good role model now. I've turned this around, you know. And his mum actually saw that I'd turned it around as well. So then the relationship, we got back together again. And in 2006, we married, which was like a huge healing for me. Very quickly, actually, we divorced. So it was desperately traumatic. But in that summer, it's a wonderful time and place for me to be alive. Just got back from Iraq. Nothing had happened. My son idolized me. At the wedding, he wore a miniature Parareg outfit matching the blues that I was wearing. The woman I loved, I was marrying her. It was a wonderful time and place.
Mm. And even after the divorce, did you still keep in contact?
Well, yeah, we had to, but no, it was very unpleasant.
Oh, really?
It was very unpleasant, yeah.
Did you still get to spend time with him when he was on leave?
Yeah, yeah. In all fairness to his mother, she's been nothing but an exceptional mother. And that means giving me time with him.
Mm.
But our relationship for a certain period was unpleasant.
Mm. I mean, the thing is with that, you've gone from one extreme to another and the other doesn't facilitate the first extreme.
Mm.
And people change and things change, but there's that, you know, that love, that bonds and that can be, you know, through my own experience, that can be very powerful. You know, it's extremely... What did it feel like? Because then we moved to Afghan in 2008 and you were really cemented then. You know, you were part of the club, you were part of the team.
Yeah, I was a solid, yeah, I was a senior Tom by then already. So, but we divorced and I was traumatized by that divorce and I was actually in a new, very exciting and loving relationship by the time Afghan came around. But yeah, I was a senior Tom. I was very confident. But you do know that you're going to Afghan. And by then in the summer, we'd already known that Three Para had been in 2006 and that they had had a fair old time of it.
Mm.
And that, you know, it was only right that we assumed that we were going to have a very similar experience. And while that's exciting and while we sign up for that, you can't deny that you're not daunted by it at the same time. You know, you might not come home. That is a fact. That's not being dramatic. You might not come home. So
it's a difference as well, isn't it? If you've been in 4 years and you're single with no children to, you know, you've got a loving relationship and you've got a child who's now, was he eight when you went?
Yeah.
7, 8.
Mm.
Did he take it well?
Afghan, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, because he thought I was kind of a hero. Again, he might say something to Vanna.
Yeah.
He was like, wow, my dad's actually a war hero, which, rightly or wrongly, that's his perspective at that time. It was very exciting for him and it was great for me because I could play up to that for him as well.
Yeah.
And just, I could run him through, I could tell him the stories that were appropriate. And I could, you know, we spent so much time in the woods together running around with stick guns and I was teaching him contact drills and, you know, just things that Reg dads do, or maybe all military dads do, I don't know. But it was great. It was great to be home and alive and to see my son idolize me, and I love my son. We had a lot of fun. I had a lot of money as well. So it was just, I took him all around the world, took him to sites around the world, like Egypt and Normandy and America and South Africa hunting and stuff like that. So it's just for an 8-year-old kid.
Oh, mate, yeah, that sounds, you're almost fulfilling your childhood in some ways.
Living vicariously, aren't we all?
But not pretty, you know, it sounds a very nourishing environment.
Oh, it was.
A negative thing. Yeah, it was. That sounds amazing.
It was.
How was landing in Afghan different to landing in Iraq?
Other than the sort of psychological being a bit daunted by it, wasn't the reality was actually not very different, because frustratingly, when we got, so I was in FOB Gibraltar. And when we got there for the first, I don't know, maybe 2 months, you know, you spend a few weeks in Bastion and then you go out. So let's say it had been 2 months in total by the time anything had happened. And loads of other people are getting shot at in other places like Inkerman and whatnot. And we're, nothing's happening. Getting a bit bored. Bored reg blokes with low morale who aren't getting shot at but want to get shot at. That was getting
pent up.
Yeah, it was getting pent up.
And to explain, so you're in a FOB, what do you mean? You're in a village, you're in a military base, what
Yeah,
you
we're
in
a small built up camp on the outskirts of it's really an abandoned village. But we didn't understand at the time, but it was the Taliban backyard. It was like literally Taliban central, and they did not like us turning up. But it took them a little while, you know, for the silly season to get started. They needed to get their crops in first, and then they started. Yeah, then they turned up.
Really? So explain that. Crops in, what do you mean?
So, their chosen crop was opium. It was the poppy. So the poppy fields, still to this day, it's one of the most beautiful places I've ever seen. An Afghan valley full of poppies. It's an incredible sight. But then you look around at the people that are doing the cultivation, the farming and the harvest, and there's a lot of fighting age males start turning up instead of women and kids, which are like at the beginning.
Oh, really? So the demographic changes when it starts to come to harvest?
Yeah, yeah.
To farm?
Yeah, yeah. And you just start counting more and more of them in the field and they're looking at you in a different way to what the villagers look at you. They're really looking at you. But for so long, no one did anything. No one did anything. And then it was June the 12th. Then they did something. That was our first. So we got there in April, and it wasn't until June the 12th when we first got our initial contact.
Mm. And what was that like?
Hellish. It was an ambush. We walked into an ambush. We lost two people straight away in the first exchange, which wasn't an exchange because we just walked into an ambush. Two people lost straight away. Our sergeant major, he was shot, but he survived. And we were stuck in a burning cornfield. It was just on fire and we were being shot at. So it was a difficult place to be, trying to deal with casualties as well. It's a shock when it's your first. I've been shot at before in Iraq, but not. There's a difference between being in contact and being shot at. I've been shot at before. But this was, yeah, I could feel them passing my ears, and two of my friends were dead as well. So, yeah, it was a shock.
How many was they that walked into it? How many of you?
Company.
Which is what?
Well, it would have been three platoons, and I think we were nearly at full strength. So,
30 blokes?
Yeah.
And then what would happen then? So two lads died, people were getting shot, it was burning. How long did all this last?
Oh, I don't know. Good question. I don't know. Because everything was on fire and we couldn't easily extract, and the helicopters refused to come in because it was so intense. We had to extract ourselves on foot, which is difficult. We didn't have the kit necessarily to. And this isn't a dig at the military. We still had the bivvy stretchers at this point, which is hard to casuvac someone. And we were still about 3 or 4K away from our FOB.
Oh, really?
And we had to, in the end, to get our dead out, we had to get a vehicle. We had to just, someone robbed a vehicle out of someone's house and we just drove back. But we still had to do a good K and a half, 2K. So that was pretty intense.
Was you fighting all the way back?
No. No, but they dug up holes in the road, and so, you know, you have to take it pretty slow. It wasn't fighting all the way back, no, but you're still on full alert. And they've dug massive holes in the road, so you can't, once we had the vehicle, we had to get back out of the vehicle.
What was the IED risk at this point? Because that was small, you're talking about small arms fire there, you know, machine guns.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, small. Well, we were aware that it could be a factor, but really it was small arms fire at this point. It wasn't until a couple of years later, I think, that the IED threat went right up. Like in 2012, we went back out. I didn't go back out, but the blokes went back out, and that was IED central, really.
Mm. You know, you just said you lost two of your mates straight away. You've still got, correct me if I'm wrong here, you've still got 4 months left.
Mm.
How did the feeling change? Emotionally, psychologically, aggressively? How did it change?
Well, shock, first of all. Shock and sadness and grief. And then you kind of really quickly got buried at grief and sadness, and you just got to turn that into aggression. And, you know, and when you're in that role, I wouldn't say that now, but in that role, you got to turn that into aggression.
Mm.
And so we tore that place apart after that, but it comes at a cost because we lost more. So it's just very quickly turned into real anger and a need for violence. And so we did our best to express ourselves. And it came at the cost of a lot of the local infrastructure and possibly a lot of locals as well, and a lot of the enemy. But like I say, we came home light, and a lot of people had life-changing injuries as well.
So after that the first contact and the first loss, what was day-to-day like, life like, patrolling, fighting? Was this then on a daily occurrence or weekly or monthly?
Yeah, daily.
Daily?
Yeah. So, but it's not always my platoon, obviously, because we'd be on guard, especially after you lose someone, you don't go back out on patrol the next day. You know, you just have a day off for one and then maybe go on guard or, you know, and then another platoon would go out. So we didn't always go out as company strength. It was platoon strength mostly. And so, you know, but every day our FOB and the platoons involved in that FOB would be in contact.
How many is a platoon?
12?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit more because we've got attachments, snipers and stuff like that, and engineers. And
mm.
So we're pretty heavy. We're going out pretty heavy. But yes, at least someone from our FOB was in contact every day. Every day. And our FOB was in contact most days.
So the FOB, the place you were staying, had gone from a place of boredom,
yeah,
a place of pent-up aggression with no outlet and a bit of disappointment, it sounds like.
Yeah, yeah.
To a place of high readiness, to a place of high stress, to a place of maximum violence and aggression.
Mm.
Did the blokes change? Let me rephrase it. Did people's personalities change? Did people switch on? Did people shine? Did people
both
become the best of themselves?
People shone and other people didn't.
Mm.
You know, you never know until you know, till you're there, which one you'll be. But yeah, some people shone. So I'm very happy with the job I did. But it was a desperately difficult place to operate. And some people didn't live up to it. But that doesn't reflect badly on them because it's such an intense environment, you know.
Mm.
But the vast majority, you know, I'm talking the vast majority of people stepped up in a massive way. And it was wonderful.
Mm.
When no one's getting hurt, it's the most exciting, most wonderful, incredible experience of my life to date. But unfortunately, when people are getting hurt, it's like the most traumatic, desperate experience to have. So it's like from one day to the next, you're just up here thinking, this is amazing. We're just giants wandering around these poppy fields in contact and having a whale of a time, but then someone gets hurt. So,
the reality.
Yeah.
Cool. How many friends did you lose? How many guys were lost?
In FOB JIB, we lost 5. And I think the battalion came back with 10. Didn't come back with 10, I should say.
And 5 were from where you were?
Yeah. Yeah. And then there's obviously life-changing injuries and stuff like that. I think I read there was a Guardian interview or an article really quickly after we came back. And that journalist, he'd done, so don't quote me on this, but I'm just going on what he said. He said that our casualty numbers were sometimes as high as those in the Second World War, and at times were as high as the First World War casualties.
Mm.
So you can see the numbers. I mean, we were nearly combat ineffective at times because we'd had so many injuries. So we actually stopped patrolling and we had to have people come in to supplement.
When you went on R&R, so when you went on leave, and I'm assuming you did go on leave in the middle or somewhere around that pit, what was the feeling like going home and then the feeling like getting back to Bry's or wherever you flew out of back?
Mm. On the day I flew out, a good friend of mine got blown up.
Fucking hell.
He's all right. He's missing a couple of bits, but he's actually all right. Mm. So I flew out. Like, he's not my very, very best friend, but he's certainly a good friend who lived opposite me in the block and spent a lot of time with me and my son when I was going through a difficult period. Mm. So a good friend who I cared deeply about. He was injured and I only heard about it as I was leaving. And obviously you don't get any news when you're back. So that was difficult, but I needed that R&R. I needed to see I got it over my birthday as well. So I was like, wow, I'm very grateful for this.
Mm.
And so I went out and my girlfriend at the time, she flew over, she was from America. She came and stayed, spent time with my son. Went out and smash, obviously. But there was a duality of me. I was that relief to be out of it, but then the guilt of being out of it.
Mm.
And then the guilt of the little whispers, I don't think I want to go back.
Mm.
But, I went back. You got a job to do.
Well, of course you've got doubts, especially when you're with your son and you're back in the UK and I don't want to dwell on it. You mentioned going out drinking again there. Was you in control of the alcohol now?
Yeah, maybe not that one night I'm thinking of.
No. It wasn't a big release, but you had control. You didn't need to drink all the time.
To be honest, I wasn't drinking very much at all, actually, because for a long period, I actually had to stop. Like all through depot, probably had one or two beers, which is probably best if you're going through Power Edge depot anyway, but... Yeah, I needed to rein that.
So it changed the whole relationship with alcohol.
My priority
changed
because I knew that alcohol was detrimental.
Yeah,
and that my priority was my professionalism and my career, and doing my job. That really was my priority. I'm fully committed to that, and alcohol I knew would ruin it. If I
was fitness a big deal. Physical fitness and your performance.
Yeah, I was very fit. I was among one of the fittest in the company. But I was slightly older than everyone else. So I had to continually, I wasn't 16 running a mile and a half in 7 minutes on half a biscuit. I had to do fitness every day. Yeah. So.
When you left to go back to Afghan, did you say goodbye to your son or was it a goodbye or was it?
I think I remember him coming with me. I remember Ross Kemp was at Bry's as well, so he was going out to film something, not with us because it was too dangerous, but with one of the other fobs where it was a bit less hairy. You just do your tell him I love him and try and convince him that I'll be all right, and maybe he was young enough to just believe it.
Mm.
And I certainly didn't tell him. I didn't tell him anything about any of the trauma. Just didn't tell him any of it.
Is the 2 weeks, and is it too, bear with me with this one, is it too long or did you switch back on to the environment? Acclimatise yourself for, 2, 3, 4 months when you're there, come home for two. Is that enough to decompress you or do you slot back in?
Probably when I got back out there, something had changed. I didn't want to be full blown contact every day anymore because I'd had just too many. It felt like I felt like I was being protected, you know, that bullets were bending around me. I imagine I'm not alone in that scenario, but I didn't want to chance my arm too much more. There's nothing you can do out there. You just go until it slows down. And in the end, it does slow down because winter starts coming in and they disappear. And they go on there, you know, then they leave it to the IEDs that they've put down.
Okay, so that their parting gift, they plant IEDs. Yeah.
Well, they did it already. They used to put it, because there's obviously a lot of crops there as well, so there's watermelon crops. They used to put IEDs under the watermelons, so, don't go picking watermelons up. They put it in the bun lines, they put it in the canals, the waterways that fed the farms.
Mm.
So if you duck for cover, you drop on one of them, which is a couple of, I think a lot of people have been hurt or worse because of that.
Mm.
You get contacted and you dive for cover, but they know where the cover is at that exact point, and you dive onto an IED.
You said there was earlier on that a lot of the enemy, a lot of the Taliban had been killed as well. Did you ever see bodies? Did you ever recover?
Oh, no, we didn't recover. No, we recovered. One guy blew himself up, didn't hurt any of us. Oh, no, minor injuries.
Mm.
We didn't recover much of him. We recovered his foot.
Mm.
Probably don't need to go into stories.
But you're covering his foot, we kind of get the picture.
We had a north wall, and on our north wall were the 50 cals and the grenade launchers and the sniper rifle. We had a crow's nest as well, and that field, I don't know why they kept attacking the north wall, but they keep coming at the north wall and it wouldn't work, it was a big wall.
Mm.
And we had lots of guns on it. Didn't work out very well for him, but I don't know, you've got to look after your own at this point. Mm. And obviously when you're out in contact, people get hurt. So it's a conflicting time and place.
Sounds like your world view had changed within 2 weeks of going away and coming back. Your view, mortality had changed. No,
it happened much earlier than that. It happened immediately after my two first friends died.
Mm.
I was like, I don't want anyone else to die. But obviously I'm a paratrooper, so it's going to happen more their side from my perspective. But I certainly didn't want any of my friends to get hurt anymore. So that was immediate. It didn't, only a seed at the back of my mind, because you still have a job to do. But by the end, by the October, when we were close to coming home, I was definitely like, this is militarily, we haven't achieved anything. Socially, we haven't helped anyone. We've made the situation worse for the locals. A lot of us have died. A lot of us are injured. Politically, we've achieved nothing, probably made it worse. So then I'm sat there reflecting on, well, what did we do?
Mm.
And I didn't come up with any answer other than those five negative things. So I was turning already by then. I was like, this isn't achieving what I thought it was. We're not killing the bad guys here. Some of them are bad and they want to hurt people. But that's true of people in my regiment as well.
Mm.
We're not the heroes and they're not the bad guys. This is how I see it now. There's a kid at that end of that battlefield that's just like me, that was angry and resentful at the world and wanted an opportunity to express himself violently and with anger. He's just like me. It's just that he lived in a different country and I turned up in his country blowing shit up, excuse my language. So no wonder he's upset. What good is it going to achieve us picking up guns and killing each other? What does it achieve?
Were you thinking like that though then? I was
coming to that. Yeah. Right at the end, I was coming to that.
But you'd have been 28, 29.
Yeah, so I was pretty mature.
Yeah.
And it all slowed down by, in the 3 weeks before we left, it was obviously very slow because part of that period is in Bastion as well.
Mm.
And nothing happens. Well, not much happens there. So a lot of time was spent reflecting. And yeah, I kept coming up with those things. I was like, well, there's nothing good come out of that.
Mm.
There are good things because it built personal character and made me the man I am today. But
yeah, I understand.
Do I need all of that to?
Yeah.
Do people have to die for that?
Such an amazing and awful time, really.
Yeah.
When you think about it, but you did come home. Some didn't, and I think we have to respect that fact. What was it like to get back and knowing that you were going to be back for a prolonged period of time? Then you weren't going anywhere anytime soon.
It was good. It was good. I was really relieved. I was very happy. I was very happy. But I was grieving pretty quickly. I was still shocked. And the contrast of the environment is jarring. I remember on the second day, so I got home. My mum and dad picked me up from Colchester with my son. And then the next morning I went out and I thought, you know what? I'm just going to go into their local village. And I went into a Waitrose. I don't know why. I wasn't even shopping. I just went into their village. And from my perspective, everyone was just totally ignorant.
Mm.
As they should be. Yeah. Totally ignorant of the trauma and what the hell has been going on in Afghanistan. No one knew. No one cared. And I was really resentful of that. I was really angry and totally out of, it's not rational, but it's how I felt. I was really angry and resentful and bitter, and I was grieving, but I was happy to be home. So yeah, again, a lot of conflict, a lot of inner conflict.
I can get that. Mm. It's not their fault. Like you said, that's no one's fault.
No.
And but people did care. They weren't you. I think that's an second. With regards to aggression, violence, I remember, I'm trying to put it into context, I remember seeing one of the tabloids, and it was some Royal Marines coming back and they were all naked wrestling or something like that. And it was outraging. Like, you can't put someone in for 6 months committing violence and aggression for their country, brackets, and then expect them to come back and drink tea. You have to have outlets. What aggressive outlets did you have when you came back? And did you see violence spilling over with yourself or those around you?
Yeah, so you have your decompression in Cyprus, but that's like a day. That's like one night, which is mayhem. It was wonderful, terrible mayhem in Cyprus. But that's in no way is that enough. But yeah, I remember I went on a night out and some guy was telling me, I didn't know him, I didn't know who he was. And he was trying to tell me how he wanted to go out to Afghanistan with a bayonet and start stabbing civilians. And I just, something just descended across me, and I don't know what was happening, but I was strangling him. I was trying to kill him. So I was on him. I was sat on his chest, strangling him to death in this car park. And then I was getting kicked in the face by his dad or brother or so, or loads of people. And then I just came to, because I wasn't letting go and I was getting torn off of this guy. And that isn't how that's not what I would normally do. I know I had anger and there was a need for violence, but I wasn't like that. I was kind of shocked the next day. I was like, okay, something's going wrong. Because you did nearly actually murder someone in the street.
Mm.
And there's a bit of a wake-up call. Like, Keith, that's not how you would normally deal with something like that. Yeah, he might have been an idiot, but we'd all had a drink. And I suppose that was kind of, a wake-up call to be like, oh, is everything quite as it should be? You're behaving somewhat differently.
Did you feel shame there? Or did you just feel
about shame, a bit guilt though, because it was bad. I tried hard.
Did you excuse yourself though with the previous 6 months?
Yeah, yeah, Yeah. So it wasn't shame. It was a bit of guilt. We're like, well, you know, he said some stupid things, but God knows I've done plenty of stupid things. And yeah, it's forgivable, but you've got to learn from something like that. You can't just try and kill someone in the street and not learn. This is my perspective.
But there'd have been an empathetic way of dealing with that, and then there was an aggressive way of dealing with that, and there's two polar opposites.
Mm.
It sounded like you chose one opposite instead of understanding where, you know, and just shrugging it off.
Mm.
Sorry, you were about to say something, was you?
No, I suppose all it was just I was understanding that there had been a psychological and behavioural change.
Mm.
I wasn't acting or thinking in a way that I recognised. I'd find myself sat in a... I spent a lot of time in America. My girlfriend was American. And so I spent a lot of time in Portland, Oregon, drinking in nice bars and going out having a nice time. But I'd find myself... I'd have a nice time and she's a beautiful woman. I'd madly in love with each other. And then I'd just... like a tear would come down my cheek. But I wasn't... like upset. I thought I was having a nice time, sat at a bar, and out of the blue just a tear would come rolling down my cheek and I'd need to go to the toilet and have a quick word with myself, and another, that's another marker, things like that. I was like, maybe something's not quite right. Maybe you're holding on to something and you might need to investigate this.
Yeah. Was that the first time the symptoms started showing, or any kind of symptom of the impact of trauma? And let's park that immediate aggression in a car park. But I'm talking about that drip feed of symptoms that comes in when exactly what you just said, and you framed it well, you know, that unexpected, in brackets, symptom.
Mm.
When did that come in time-wise? What year was that?
So I think the relationship with Amy, her name is the American, is quite important. We had a very strong relationship, but she was finding it quite difficult to know what to do with me. There were other issues for sure in the relationship, but she was finding it hard to know what to do about me. And I sure as hell didn't know what to do about me. So the relationship started to fall apart. There were other reasons, but the relationship started to fall apart. And then that triggered me, that lot, because I thought this was a lifelong relationship. You know, I thought she was the one.
Mm.
And then that took me all the way back to when I was 20, when Dylan's mum left and all hope was lost and I wasn't wanted, I wasn't loved anymore. But on top of a relationship breakdown, I was grieving for my dead friends. I was shocked and traumatized. I was depressed and anxious. But now I lost the love of my life. And then it really started getting very difficult. And that's when, so in 2010, that would be, I started, symptoms other than behavioural started to appear.
Well, what, just before we go there, what behavioural changes did Amy, was it?
Mm.
What behavioural changes did she see to make her feel like she didn't know what to do with you?
Just this sadness and grief. You know, it's hard to know what to do with grief.
Joy. Did you have joy in your life?
She was my joy and my son was my joy. And then she went, and then it's like, 50% of my joy is gone. It's hard to know what to do with someone that's so desperately traumatized and grieving and sad and desperate and depressed and anxious. And she's young, you know, she was like 23, 24, something like this. No fault of hers, just the hell do you do with someone like me?
It's not the brochure she originally got.
No, exactly. The brochure was the guy before.
Yeah, very in a short guy. Space of time, the brochure had changed. And,
exactly.
2010. Where were you there?
2010. I was still in. I'd actually taken a posting to Sandhurst because I needed to get out of the reg, and I'd foreseen that I might be a good teacher, but no school was going to take just a war-torn lance jack from the reg. You can't just step into a classroom. So I spoke with my boss and we decided that I started a open university course. and they thought that the time at Sandhurst would be less demanding of me and that I was around other people that were educating themselves. So the officer cadets, they get educated as well while they're there, and that I would have time to study. So therefore, with the idea of leaving to become a teacher, because there was a soldiers to teacher transition project at that point. I was actually one of them, the early ones, and then it got stopped halfway through.
Really?
Yeah, which is why I then went on selection, because it's the only thing I've got left.
Mm. So what, tell me about the symptoms in Sandhurst.
That was migraines, cluster migraines, which are horrendous. They are really unpleasant. That's a migraine that lasts for 3 days. And then you get a couple of days rest and then it will come back again. And I probably got one of them at least once every month. And that is a migraine.
Oh, cluster. Sorry, so you have 3 days, then nothing for a few days and it comes back again. And that's the cluster.
Yeah.
Yep. The return of it.
Yeah.
Right, I'm with you. Okay.
And then, and they just don't stop. So that was draining. And I was also sweating uncontrollably in all situations, all of the time. In bed, on my own, in public, in a group, to anything, I was just dripping with sweat. And that's
what way? Armpits, hands?
Armpits, hands, face. Everything was just dripping with sweat.
And how was that impacting your life?
It's embarrassing.
Yeah.
And so it made me anxious. And so I was already probably anxious and depressed. But then I had a physical symptom that could be seen by others, which is embarrassing, which made me more anxious. So I began to spiral and I'm grieving as well, and blah, blah, blah. All of this is happening and there's no pills for that. I tried antidepressants. I tried talking therapies. For me, it didn't do much good.
Within the military kind of health system, I suppose, you know, were you going to military?
Yeah.
The med centre and then getting referred on from there?
Yeah.
So, and was that supportive? Was it fit for purpose? For you?
No, not for me. For me. Yeah, I've got my views on pharmaceuticals, on antidepressants. I'm not sure that they are, now that I've educated myself.
Mm. But at that time, you know, this stuff wasn't working for you. You were still in this, you know, this, and I can get that. That is an embarrassing situation if you're going to shake someone's hand or if you're walking around and you're sweating, especially as someone who is quite often looked up to, you know, especially if you're walking around with a load of cadets, people are looking up to you. And
I was the only guy in Sandhurst that had been to war at that point. So I was literally the guy. Mm. I was a pararegistrant. I was only a lance corporal, but I'd been a section commander in Afghan.
Mm.
So I was the guy.
Mm.
And I wanted to be the guy, but I was also sweating and it's embarrassing. So it made me really, really anxious.
2010, and there's so much changed, especially the 5 and then the 10 years since then. And I'm not going to fast forward us too much yet. 2012, you got out after an unsuccessful attempt at Special Forces selection.
Mm-hmm.
And before we went on, you essentially said that there was nothing else for you to do after that. So you left and you wanted a new challenge.
Yeah.
You went to JP Morgan and you were there for 3 years. Why, puzzling really, you left something like the parachute regiment and joined almost the opposite really, JP Morgan. Why did you do that?
So when I got off of selection, I was... My OC in Afghan was then the CO. And I think him and his 2IC, who was my former boss, they kind of held me in quite high regard from our time, shared time in Afghan. So the CO and the 2IC, I got back off selection. They just said, well, we've read your reports from selection. Sandhurst, you were shining, like I got commendation and stuff there. And so they kind of screwed it up for me. They said, you clearly want out. We might be able to help. So my former RSM, Ben Huxley, he was at JP Morgan and they were looking for someone to be his assistant, to be his sort of mentee.
Mm.
And they said, you can go and interview for that job if you want. And it was a lot of money. And it was a job where you get to wear a suit and no one shoots at you. And there's already Reg in the building as well, so you're not totally alone. And you're living the big life in the city, you know, going out drinking cocktails again. I could drink again by then.
Mm.
And so it was exciting. And I bought a flat based off of the salary of that income as well from JP Morgan. So I was living in London with a big power suit on, you know, cutting around like I thought I owned the place. But actually, Canary Wharf and JP Morgan is a really intense environment, a very intense environment. And I made some good friends there, some very good friends. But wow, it's demanding. Mm. And especially for someone in my position where I was traumatized and I had no way, I hadn't healed in any way. And in fact, I remember it, I left on a Friday. I left the Reg, I walked out of the gate on a Friday. And it was the next Monday, I walked in to JP Morgan. And it was just a massive shock, but it was exciting. But it was a massive shock and demands on me that I put on myself. Ben was very gentle with me, very respectful. But, you know, you've got to earn that amount of money. You don't get it for free like you do in the Reg. I kind of started to fall apart a little bit. That's when it's really started coming on.
And did you look, because it had been so unsuccessful in 2010 with conventional, in brackets, again, there's a lot of brackets going on, you know, this conventional pharmaceuticals, did you find yourself self-medicating in any way or seeking medicine?
So I thought it was only, so when I got out, I saw a GP, a CVGP. I'm still suffering with all of these symptoms that you can see that I've suffered with. And he said, well, why don't you give antidepressants another go? And why don't you give talking therapies another go? So I did. Antidepressants are still, for me, poison. And actually the talking therapy at this point, the one time she was actually very helpful. But it's not healing. Talking therapy is not a healing tool. It's a management tool and an education. You can learn about how your mind works and behaves. So it's a valuable education, but it's not a healing process. It can be very valuable though, which I found it incredibly valuable, but I realized that it wasn't going to sort me out at all. I just understood myself a little bit better now, so I was a little bit more aware.
For what reason? Sorry to interrupt. Because it was too scary, because it was too painful, because it just wasn't making you move quickly inside your brain?
Just because there's things that it can't, that process can't do. I'm a believer that the body holds a lot of our trauma. It's not all just psychological. And so you've got a lot of work to do in your physical body as much as you have in your mind. And talking therapies highlight behaviors so that, yes, sometimes you might have the strength and the wherewithal to change some of those behaviors, but some of those behaviors might be too strong, and in my case, were too overwhelming to begin breaking down, certainly only when you get 12 sessions on the NHS. But it was still very valuable.
And what were you feeling now? Was you still sweating? Had things changed? Would your nervous system, how was that working? How was you physically? You mentioned the physical side of things. What was going on?
Yeah, I realized I needed help. And a few things happened all in a very short period of time. One is that a dear friend of mine actually invited me to his house and sat me down in his kitchen. And he said, I've bought you this. And it was at that time, it was called a legal high, which was basically ecstasy, but with one molecule changed so that it was legal. They very quickly made it illegal again, but we managed to get one each. And he's very good at sitting and listening and just listening. So we had this, what would be MDMA, essentially. And it helped a great, great deal. It helped me, you know, I'd be carrying my Bergen around, a Bergen of trauma on my back. And I was just carrying it around for no real reason. And so those few hours in that kitchen with MDMA, or it wasn't MDMA, but something very...
It turned off the amygdala. It turned off fight flight, did it, in the brain?
Yeah.
It allowed you to speak.
Yeah, it allowed me to speak. It just... I was introduced to compassion. I was introduced to forgiveness. And I was introduced to gratitude. They're like the real three things that I took from that. And that I didn't need to carry this stuff around with me all the time. And that, what happened there after that, the way that I see it happened is that I actually had this spiritual awakening pretty soon after that. It kind of cracked everything open. It didn't change my symptoms, didn't heal my symptoms in any way. So half of me was having this really intense spiritual experience where I was seeing all sorts of weird things. But then the other half of me in my physical body, I was being tormented by tension and trauma. And so I was still sweating and I was still embarrassed and therefore I was anxious.
Mm-hmm.
So yet again, another period of this duality, this conflict I was experiencing with myself. And so I realized that I needed to look at my body. I needed to look at what was going on in my body. And so a guy at JP Morgan, a colleague of mine, really lovely guy, he suggested that I should try Tai Chi. But I was still in pararegg mode when he suggested that. And I was like, no. Like, I'll fight people.
Yeah, I'll box, but I'm not doing Tai Chi.
Yeah, I'll bite. And I was boxing at that point. I'll box and I'll beat people up. It'll make me feel better. But no, I'm not just mincing around waving my hands. Okay, well, I thought I'd offer it. But anyway, so I went home that night and I looked it up on YouTube anyway. And I did a 4-hour class on YouTube of Tai Chi in my front room in my flat.
Oh, really?
And I had a profound experience. I was not focused on, I didn't feel tension in my body. I didn't feel that I had a frantic mind. I was just focused on moving my body in a way that man told me to in the video. I had 4 hours of peace, which I hadn't had for years.
A physical meditation.
Yeah, exactly. And then the next night I did the same thing. I did the same 4 hours again and I did it again and I did it again. And then my son bought me a DVD. So I did the DVD and then I built up the sort of balls to go to an actual class because, again, I was still kind of, oh, I'm a paratrooper. I don't want to be seen at a Tai Chi class. But I went and I had an amazing time and I was finding real, genuine peace in these hours. Outside of those hours, all bets were off.
Mm.
But I knew it was important. And so I was really enjoying this practice. But then also I came to be aware, actually, a friend of mine, another friend who's an American, she then told me about this thing called ayahuasca. And then everything started changing really very quickly after that.
Well, let's jump on a plane to Peru. Why did you just mentioned why you found yourself there. What was... how did it happen? You land in Peru, Lima, whatever it is.
Yeah, I landed in Lima. I got another flight down to a place called Tarapoto. And my friend had asked some people in Tarapoto to come and meet me at the airport. They did a lovely, lovely couple. And I got in a car with them. I'd never met them. I'd never spoken to them.
Are they from Peru?
Yeah, they lived there, yeah. And so they said, welcome. Let's get in the car. We've got a long journey ahead of us. And I thought, okay, fine. And so we drove for about an hour down to this tiny jungle village, Chazuta. And like the road is in terrible condition. There's landslides all over the place. But it's a great adventure already. I'm having a whale of a time. Get to Chazuta. It is a jungle village. And as a white man, I don't think they see a lot of white people there. And so there was lots of interest. And we had to get on a boat. We went on a boat upriver for about an hour as well. And we got off at a tiny, tiny little village that was like four huts. And then we hiked up into the jungle for another hour or so. And we arrived at this tiny little wooden hut on stilts that had no windows, no room, no nothing. It was just a wooden hut on stilts, no electricity, no running water, There was a river nearby and it had loads of banana and fruit trees all around it, totally isolated in the middle of the jungle. And they said, here you go, here's your home. And I was like, okay. So, I mean, it wasn't really daunting because I was used to, you know, that sort of stuff doesn't really daunt me, but I did think, I kind of don't know what to do. And they said, just relax and don't do anything. A guy will come and visit you soon. So I stayed there and I laid in the river and I ate fruit off the trees and minced around. And then one day, this shaman, I didn't know him, turns out he was the village shaman, walks up to my hut and he's carrying this Coca-Cola bottle, just a 75 centiliter Coca-Cola bottle. And it looks like it's been dropped in mud. It's disgusting. It looks awful. And he didn't speak English and I spoke only very little Spanish. So he told me, like, oh, I'm the person that gives you ayahuasca. Like, okay, what do I do? And he said, well, you just lay down next to me, listen to my words. I'm going to sing and just try to relax and breathe. And so, he gave me this shot glass of just mud, which is ayahuasca. It's just brown, dirty puddle water, it looks like. It's not a very pleasant drink. I smashed that shot glass. I lay down next to him and he started singing. And as I started listening to his words, I just started, I fell asleep. And this is where I'm going to use language that might not resonate with everyone, but it's just the language that I've got to explain how it happened. Okay? So I laid down and I fell asleep. So me, this body that I have, I was asleep on the floor in a hut in Peru. But I woke up not having a body, just in space, no body at all. But I was still me. But I was in space and I could watch the planets and the stars and I could observe time and I could hear his songs. And I was just like, this is amazing, but what the hell is going on? And it was kind of a typical psychedelic experience, really, just like cool things happening, but not with too much value at this point. Mm. It's like, it's really interesting to actually observe time working, or wow, look at the way that the planets work and the objectivity of seeing planets from such distances and stars. And but then what happened the next time, so a few days later, he came back and he gave me another shot and I did the same thing again. And the same thing happened. I fell asleep, but I woke up somewhere else. And I was looking at the planets and I was thinking, this is amazing. This is what an experience this is. And then this voice came out of the darkness and said, have you finished playing? And I thought, like, that's the voice of God, because it was nothing, came from nowhere. It was just this voice. And I thought, well, if it's the voice of God, I'm going to be like, yes, I have finished playing. What do you want me to do? And the voice said, do you want to start working? And then I understood that I was going to get everything that I wanted. And the voice said, I'm going to give you everything you need. And I knew that in this body laying on the floor in the hut, I was crying with joy and relief and hope. I was hysterically crying. But also this part of me that was not in my body was just really geared up to work. And so then I kind of woke up again in this classroom, and the voice is now a body, and it's this sort of ghost of this old woman. And I understand that she is ayahuasca and she is my teacher and I'm a student. And the things she taught me that night are just the most profound things I've ever been taught. And it lasted lifetimes. Even though it was only hours for this body, in the way that I experienced it was that I got lifetimes of education on how to heal myself and how to help others and how to change my behavior. And it was just the most profound experience of one of the most profound experiences of my life, if not the most. It was wonderful. And when I woke up from that, I knew I'd been healed psychologically. I still had work in my body. I knew that I was very tense in my body. But psychologically, I knew that I had been healed of all of my trauma. All of my psychological trauma had been healed. And I was just a brand new man. I was so happy. I was crying with laughter. It was just the most remarkable experience.
Two nights.
Two doses. Two nights, yeah.
And then you came back.
Well, I had a few more days. You know, I was there for like 10 days in total.
Yeah, but you, no more ceremonies?
No, I only had two.
Two?
Yeah.
And then you did another week, let's say another week there. Were you happy with... Did you need to have another ceremony? Did you feel, oh, I'll do that again?
No.
It wasn't like you'd become addicted.
God, no. No. And actually the science, if you want to look into the science of it, is these things are at the bottom of the list of all compounds and drugs that you would consider drugs. These are the bottom of the list for addictive.
And the active ingredients, DMT, is that right?
In ayahuasca, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you came back, had this carried on, this profound experience, had this really impacted you in this positive way?
Yeah.
I mean, you're smiling now.
Yeah. Yeah, it changed everything. It was immediate. And I'm not going to sit here and say that that's what happens for everyone.
No.
All I can say is what I experienced is that I was healed of all of my psychological trauma up until that point in my life. It was the greatest gift I've ever had.
Mm. And that was 2014?
Yeah, Easter. Yeah.
And when did the physical symptoms kind of...
So that's why I mentioned Tai Chi, because of the significance of that work. And that I actually came home. So I went to China after that. So I took a holiday from JP Morgan to go to Peru. And then I said to JP Morgan, I'm going to quit. I'm quitting. And they said, oh, okay, what are you doing? I was like, oh, I've booked a flight to China and I'm going to study Tai Chi full time with a master in the mountains. And they're like,
weirdo.
Okay, so you went to Peru and took some jungle medicine. And now you're quitting a very well-paid job at the biggest bank in the world, and you're going to go and study Tai Chi in a temple in China. Okay. I mean, you're a big boy, do what you want. But yeah, the looks were weird. And my mum and dad were a bit worried. But I went to China and I went twice actually to China, and I had a teacher here in the UK, very talented teacher, who taught me the skills of how we can go about systematically relieving tension from the body. And it's incredibly valuable. And that's what I do professionally now.
Mm.
I know I have Heroic Hearts as a charitable organization, but professionally, I teach these practices of how you release tension from your body.
Physically with Tai Chi?
Physically.
Yeah.
Tai Chi is that one of a multitude of practices. Ah. It's just one. There are others.
And who do you deal with? Who is your clients?
All sorts. I've dealt with young adults with autism. I've taught veterans. I go into banks, which is wonderful. You know, I get to go back into the environment, try and, you know, go back in and help a few people. Police, they've employed me. Just regular civvies as well. You know, I have regular public classes. I have students in Canada and America. And yeah, it's wonderful. This is what I do. It's that important to me. This is what I choose to do professionally.
And 2014, they were the only two ceremonies with ayahuasca that you've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
It then changed your life for the better.
Mm-hmm.
The movement came in. The Tai Chi, or what you just mentioned there,
mm-hmm.
February 2020, you then set up the UK or the Heroic Hearts UK. It is an American, we won't go into the American too much, but Heroic Hearts UK, what is it?
So I'd like to just talk about why, as opposed to...
Perfect. Why did you set up?
In the summer, I believe it was 2018. So I'd had my healing and I was working on the body. Summer of 2018, and I might be wrong, but there was a period of about 2 months where there were two suicides every day in the veterans community. Like, I was part of a Facebook group and people were killing themselves at a rate that was, I was just shocked and I felt a bit helpless. Loads of blokes on Facebook were really supportive and trying to help people, but I knew that that's not, you know, that sort of support only goes so far. Sending someone a nice message or even turning up for a cup of tea, that only goes so far. And I kind of maybe arrogantly felt like, you know what, I think I might have a golden ticket here that I can share. And so it took me about a year and a half to kind of, you know what, Keith, if you don't do it, who the hell is going to do it?
Mm.
So I was, in my mind, I was trying to, like, well, what? How would I get people, how would I get veterans from the UK to Peru? And is that legal, or like, am I even qualified to do that? So anyway, I just thought, well, if not me, then who? So I did. And as soon as I started, before I'd even started Heroic Hearts, it was just me. I was just offering it. I will take you to Peru. And I had seven guys booked up, and I found someone that was paying for all of us to go. So one guy in America, he said, I'll pay for all of you to go. So I was kind of like, well, something's clearly right. I'm doing something right, because this was effortless. And then COVID happened, lockdown. And then I thought, you know what? I've got this time. We can't do it. We can't do ops. We can't do operations. I go to Peru. So, you know, I'm going to spend some time to create an organization. And that's when I heard about Heroic Hearts in the US, which is, and then what are we? We are an independent and not-for-profit organization that connects in the UK. We connect UK military and emergency services veterans with psychedelic retreat centers in countries where that practice is legal. So Peru, Costa Rica, Netherlands, and other countries. I think Portugal as well.
Portugal, yeah.
But we don't deal with Portugal yet. So that's who we are and that's why. And it's been an incredible year. We haven't, because of lockdowns, we still haven't managed to do any operations, but we've got a Peru trip booked for November 15th. I think that's right, November 15th. And we've got a psilocybin retreat booked in autumn, but we don't have a precise date for that because for obvious reasons. So psilocybin is the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, which is also, alongside ayahuasca, has been shown to have incredible, incredible therapeutic benefits.
Just so, are you a charity, or are you still just doing it by yourself, but as a program? How are you navigating cash and things like that?
So we are, our application to the Charity Commission is in, but it's a to and fro process. So they're saying, well, you need to do this. And then our lawyers say, okay.
Yep.
It's an ongoing process. So at the moment, we're not a registered charity. That's why I said we're an independent not-for-profit organization, but soon we should be a registered charity.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, we've got to do a bit more work before that actually happens.
Mm. But so we, Peru, ayahuasca, ceremonies, like, you did a one-on-one with a shaman and yourself in a hut in the middle of the jungle.
Yeah.
That's
not what other people are going to get.
This is what I'm, so yeah. What are we looking at with the, you know, the research you've done with the links in with the US, what they're finding best practice? Is it with a group of people, not necessarily that I've served together, but have experienced similar things and have understand it a little bit more? Is it group or is it one-on-one? What? I mean, financially, it sounds better to do it as a group.
Well, as a charitable organization, we're going to need to do it as groups. So we do it in groups. You know, we're talking about eights. So small groups. I'm, you know, group therapy is great. I'm just of the perspective that I think both have an incredible value, and I would always try and do it by myself.
Mm.
You know, if I was going to do it again, I would do it by myself. But there's a great benefit to being in a group and getting that heat, because you can share your experiences.
You can share your experience. But so if you've drank the ayahuasca.
All together, yeah.
Yeah, all together. You then lay down a mattress or something.
Have your experience.
Have your experience. But that's a very personal experience, is that right?
Oh, yeah, totally.
Okay, so it's not like you're hugging each other and you're, you know, you're chatting and stuff during the...
No, I mean, some people might be
able
to... I suppose. Yeah, some people might be able to get a few words out here and there. But yeah, if you've got... Yeah, if you've got the correct dose,
yeah,
probably you're not going to be in that room for very long. You know, you're going to be elsewhere.
And the shaman's there and these other people.
He wouldn't call himself a shaman. The guy that I'm thinking of, he wouldn't call himself a shaman, but an ayahuasquero is the term.
Yeah.
Some people have negative connotations about a shaman, but they do the same role, you know.
Yeah.
He's actually an English guy as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, lovely man. The one in Peru that we use. Yeah, lovely guy.
Sorry, mate. So you've got the these ceremonies that are, you know, groups of eight, and it's in Peru where it's legal. It's all been done, and then the psilocybin. So that's the active ingredient in magic mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
This is in the Netherlands. The trip you're going on, and how is that facilitated? How is that going to look? The structure of that.
So that's a very similar structure. Might be slightly bigger numbers, only slightly, but the difference is not only the active ingredient, which again is psilocybin, not DMT. There, because ayahuasca in Netherlands was actually recriminalized last year because it was legal. Now it's been recriminalized. But actually, psilocybin in mushrooms is still illegal in Netherlands. So we have to use things called psilocybin truffles. Mm. You've still got the same stuff in it. But actually the focus of this retreat in the Netherlands is, whereas we're normally open to UK military and emergency services, this retreat is solely for UK military veterans who believe that they might have experienced a traumatic brain injury. And so we are concurrently with the Psychedelic Centre, the Centre for Psychedelic Research at Imperial College, which is headed up by Robin Carhart-Harris. We've teamed up with them to do an observational research study on the participants at that retreat to see the effects of psilocybin on the actual damage to the brain. So normally people go for psychedelics to heal from psychological trauma. But now we're interested in looking at physiological trauma on the brain. So a blast injury or a concussive injury damages the brain. And that damage can, it's being shown, can actually lead to mental ill health. So it can be the precursor to mental health issues. So if we can heal the physical brain, it might then help heal the psychology.
The regeneration of neurological pathways, things like that.
Yes.
With the active ingredient, the psilocybin.
Yeah.
Done in larger doses, like a therapeutic dose.
Yes.
Mm.
But with the focus of measuring... Not in an invasive way, because it's an observational study, but yeah, so it's pretty exciting stuff, and it's the first of its kind in the world. So it's a pretty big deal. And we're concurrently doing it with the US, who are doing it in Jamaica.
Mm.
So UK is going to the Netherlands, for obvious reasons, and the US vets are going to Jamaica.
They've got the better deal.
Yeah.
and where can we... I'm going to ask you, the last question I'm going to ask you is what's next? What's the longer plan? But before that, how can people, if they're interested, find where you are?
Yep. So the Heroic Hearts website is heroicheartsuk.com. And it's a lovely website that we've had designed. The ayahuasca and psilocybin retreats are on that website separately.
Mm-hmm.
I invite everyone to just have a little look at what we're trying to achieve. And if they feel like they could submit themselves as an applicant, fill out the forms. And then we start the vetting process. But there are fairly strict requirements.
Mm.
So not everyone, this is not appropriate for everyone.
Mm.
Yeah, there's a small spectrum of people that we're able to try and help.
Right now, and but let's not put anyone off there as well, because
no, sure,
let's, you know, come, you know, if you feel apprehensive about it, come forward and connect, and you can sign up to your newsletter, and you can still connect on social media, yes, and things like that, and stay active and look at things and listen to things like this podcast and future ones and ones we've done in the past.
Mm.
What's next? Where do you want to see it in any time frame? Where do you want?
Well, in the near to medium term, I just want to get people the help that I believe these medicines can provide as quickly as possible. So some people go along the route of clinical research, which is great because clinical research and that data and is going to help convince decision makers in government to reclassify these substances. But ultimately, people are killing themselves right now. And there's a medicine out there that might help, or there's several medicines out there that might help. And so we're interested in just getting those people access, if they're appropriate, getting them access to those medicines. There's no guarantees. It's not necessarily a magic bullet like I got. Maybe that's not the right term.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah.
There's no guarantees, but I've got to try. You know, we have got to try and help these people not suffer anymore. And then clinical research and changes in drug laws, which we're also working towards, that is medium to long term. And I say we are actively engaged in that political and social aspect of psychedelics as well.
Mm. Our drug policy is archaic, and it's one of the only ones that hasn't been changed in decades and decades, as it has been reviewed. This conversation was not about advocating going out and buying an E or a DMT off someone off the street, whatever it is, but used therapeutically and with clinical guidance and advice and done it in the right way, this could be, this could be a real game changer.
Yeah, I would stress that. Well, I'm not condoning, and we don't condone recreational use of these substances, because for some people that can be very dangerous.
Mm.
So, yes, in a correct setting with people that are very experienced at working with these substances in safe environments, having gone through a vetting process, then I'm very hopeful that a lot of people can get a great deal of, I have to be careful with my words, they can help.
Heal. And
yeah. Some people don't like it if we use that word.
Mm, I like it.
I feel healed.
Keith, thanks so much, and we will leave it there.